Terrorists. You're Taliban.
The day's light was dimming. Processing had taken 3 hours, and the four men had been in the cage for three more. They were each given small cardboard boxes with the words barbecue pork rib printed on the side. Inside was a set of plastic cutlery, a packet of cheese spread, two crackers, a packet of orange drink crystals, and a bag of pork ribs. These were military-style meals, ready to eat. Zaytoun told the guard that he and Nasser were Muslims and couldn't eat pork. The guard shrugged. "Then don't eat it." Zaytoun and Nasser ate the crackers and cheese and gave the rest to Todd and Ronnie. With the darkness coming, the sound behind them seemed to grow louder. Already he was tired, but Zaytoun knew that the engine would ensure that none of them slept. He'd worked on ships before, in engine rooms, but this was louder than that, louder than anything he had ever known. In the glare of the floodlights, it resembled a great furnace, moaning and ravenous.
"We can pray," Zaytoun said to Nasser. He'd caught Nasser's eye, and he knew what he was thinking. They needed to pray, were urged to do so 5 times a day, but Nasser was nervous. Would this arouse more suspicion? Would they be mocked or even punished for worshipping? Zaytoun saw no reason not to do so, even while being held in an outdoor cage. "We must," he said. If anything, he thought, they needed to pray more often and with great fervor.
"What about wudu?" Nasser asked.
The Quran asked that Muslims wash themselves before their prayers, and there was no means of doing so here. But Zaytoun knew that the Quran allowed that if there was no water available, Muslims could use dust to cleanse themselves, even if only ceremoniously. And so they did so. They took gravel from the ground and rubbed it over their hands and arms, their heads and feet, and they knelt and performed salat. Zaytoun knew their prayers were arousing interest from the guards, but he and Nasser didn't pause. As the night went black, the lights came on. Floodlights from above and from the building opposite. The night grew darker and cooler, but the lights stayed on, brighter than day. The men weren't given sheets, blankets, or pillows. Soon there was a new guard on duty, sitting on the chair opposite them, and they asked him where they were supposed to sleep. He told them that he didn't care where they slept, as long as it was on the pavement where he could see them. Zaytoun didn't care about sleep this night. He wanted to stay awake in case a supervisor of some sort, a lawyer, any civilian at all, happened by. The other men tried to rest their heads on the pavement in the crooks of their arms. No one slept. Even when someone would find themselves in a place where they might be able to rest, the sound of the engine, its vibrations in the ground, took over. There could be no sleep in this place. Somewhere in the small hours, Zaytoun tried to drape himself over the steel rack, stomach down. He found a minute or so of rest this way, but it was a position he couldn't maintain. He tried to lean his back against it, arms crossed. It couldn't be done. Other guards occasionally walked by with their German shepherds, but the night was otherwise uneventful. There was only the face of the guard, his M16 by his side, the floodlights coming from every angle, illuminating the faces of Zaytoun's fellow prisoners, all drawn, exhausted, half mad with fatigue and confusion. Wednesday, September 7th. When the sky began to pale into dawn, Zaytoun realized he hadn't slept at all. He'd closed his eyes for a few minutes at a time, but hadn't found sleep. He'd refused to lie on the pavement, But even if he could have brought himself to do so, even if he could quell the panic about his situation, his family, his home, the uninterrupted drone of the engine would have kept him awake. He watched as the night guard left and was replaced by a new man. The new guard's expression was the same as his predecessor's, seeming to take for granted the guilt of the men in the cage. Zaytun and Nasser performed their wudu and their salat, and when they were done, they stared at the guard who was staring at them. Zaytun became more alert, even optimistic, as the sky brightened. He assumed that with each day since the hurricane, the city would find its way towards some kind of stability, and that the government would soon send help. With that help, the chaos that had brought him to this cage would be reined in, and the misunderstanding manifested here would be mitigated. Zaytun convinced himself that the previous day had been an aberration, that today would bring a return to reason and procedure. He would be allowed a phone call, would learn about the charges against him, might even see a public defender or a judge. He'd call Kathy, and she'd hire the best lawyer she could find, and this would be over in hours. The other men in the cage, all of whom had finally found some rest during the night, woke one by one and stood to stretch. Breakfast was brought. Again it was MREs, this time including ham slices. Zaytun and Nasser ate what they could and gave the rest to Todd and Ronnie. As the prison awoke, Zaytun examined the chain-link structure closely. It was about 150 feet long. The razor wire was new, the portable toilets new. The fencing was new and of high quality. He knew that none of this had existed before the storm. New Orleans Union Passenger Terminal had never before been used as a prison. He did some rough calculations in his mind. It would have taken maybe 6 flatbed trucks to get all the fencing to the station. He saw no forklifts or heavy machinery. The cages must have been assembled by hand. It was an impressive feat to get such a construction project completed so soon after the storm. But when had they done it? Zaytun had been brought into the station on September 6th, 7.5 days after the hurricane passed through the city. Even under the best of circumstances, building a prison like this would have taken 4 or 5 days. That meant that within a day of the storm's eye passing over the region, officials were making plans for the building of a makeshift outdoor prison. Fencing and razor wire would have had to be located or ordered. The toilets and floodlights and all other equipment would have had to be borrowed or requisitioned. It was a vast amount of planning and execution. A regular contractor would have wanted weeks to complete the task and would have used heavy machinery. Without machines, dozens of men would be needed. To do it as quickly as they had, 50 men would be needed, maybe more. And who were these men? Who did this work? Were there contractors and laborers working around the clock on a prison days after the hurricane? It was mind-boggling. It was all the more remarkable, given that while the construction was taking place on September 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, thousands of residents were being plucked from rooftops, were being discovered alive and dead in attics. At midday, Zaytun heard something strange. The sound of buses at the bus station. He looked up to see a school bus arriving at the far end of the lot. From it descended 30 or more prisoners, one woman among them, in orange jumpsuits. They were the incarcerated from the Jefferson Parish and Kenner jails, those who had been in jail before the storm. Within the hour, the long row of cages began to fill, and again, just like Guantanamo, all prisoners could be seen by anyone from any angle. Now, with the orange uniforms completing the picture, the similarities were too strong to ignore. Quickly after each group was locked into a cage, they were warned about touching the fence. Any touching of any fence would result in severe consequences. And so they came to know the strange rules of their incarceration. The pavement would be their bed, the open-door toilet would be their bathroom, and the steel rack would be the seat they could share. But for the first hour, while the new prisoners got acquainted with their new cells, there was much yelling from the guards about where and how to stand and sit, what not to touch. A man and a woman were housed one cage away from Zaytun, and soon a rumor abounded that the man was a sniper, that it had been he who'd been shooting at the helicopters that had tried to land on the roof of a hospital. Lunch was different than previous meals. This time the guards brought ham sandwiches to the cages and then stuffed them through the holes in the wire. Again, Zaytun and Nasser didn't eat. The presence of dogs was constant. There were at least two always visible, their handlers sure to parade them past the cages in close proximity. Occasionally one would explode into barking at some prisoner. Someone in Zaytun's cage mentioned Abu Ghraib, wondering at what point they'd be asked to pose naked in a vertical pyramid, and which guard would lean into the picture, grinning. By 2 o'clock, there were about 50 prisoners at the bus station, but Zaytun's cage was still the only one with its own dedicated guard.
"You really think they consider us terrorists?" Nasser asked.
Todd rolled his eyes.
"Why else would we be alone in this cell while everyone else is crammed together? We're the big fish here. We're the big catch."
Throughout the day, a half dozen more prisoners came through the station and were brought to the cages. These men were dressed in their civilian clothes. They must have been picked up after the storm, as Zaytun and his companions had been. The pattern was clear now. The prisoners who were being transferred from other prisons came by bus and weren't processed, while those arrested after the storm were processed inside and brought through the back door. By overhearing the guards and prisoners talking, Zaytun realized the prison had been given at least two nicknames by the guards and soldiers. A few referred to it as Angola South, but far more were calling it Camp Greyhound. In the afternoon, one of the guards approached a man in the cage next to Zaytun's. He talked to an orange-clad prisoner for a few moments, gave him a cigarette, and then returned to the bus station. Moments later, the guard reappeared, leading a small television crew. The guard led them straight to the man he'd given a cigarette to. The reporter, Zaytun could see now the crew was from Spain, conducted an interview with the prisoner, and then, after a few minutes, he approached Zaytun with the microphone and began to ask a question.
"Nope," the guard yelled, "not that one."
The crew was ushered back into the station.
"Holy shit," Todd said. "They bribed that dude."
As they were leaving, the cameraman swept his lens over the whole outdoor jail, Zaytun included. There was a bright light attached to the camera, and being viewed that way, in the glare of a floodlight, and shown to the world as a criminal in a cage, made Zaytun furious. It was a lie. But Zaytun had a sudden hope. Given that the crew was Spanish, that the footage might be broadcast to his brother in Malaga, Ahmed would see it. He saw everything, and he would tell Kathy, and Kathy would know where he was. At the same time, Zaytun couldn't bear the thought of his family in Syria knowing he was being kept like this. No matter what happened, if and when he was released, he couldn't let them know that this had happened to him. He didn't belong here. He wasn't this. He was in a cage, being viewed, gaped at, seen as visitors to the zoo see exotic animals, kangaroos, and baboons. The shame was greater than any his family had ever known. In the late afternoon, a new prisoner was brought through the bus station doors. He was white, about 50, thin and of average height, with dark hair and tanned skin. Zaytun thought little of him until his own cage was opened and the man was pushed inside. There were now 5 prisoners in their cage. No one knew why. The man was dressed in jeans and a short-sleeved shirt, and seemed to have stayed clean during and after the storm. His hands, face, and clothing were all without dirt or stain. His attitude, too, bore no shadow of the suffering of the city at large. He introduced himself to Zaytun and the 3 others, shaking each of their hands like a conventioneer. He said his name was Jerry. He was gregarious, full of energy, and made jokes about his predicament. The 4 men had spent a sleepless night in an outdoor cage and didn't have the energy to make much conversation, but this new prisoner more than filled the silence. He laughed at his own jokes and about the bizarre situation they found themselves in. Without prompting, Jerry told the story of how he'd come to be arrested. He'd stayed behind during the storm, just as he always did during hurricanes. He wanted to protect his house, and after Katrina passed, he realized he needed food and couldn't walk to any stores nearby. His car was on high ground and was undamaged, but he was out of gas. So he found a length of tubing in his garage and was in the middle of siphoning gasoline from a neighbor's car. He planned to tell his neighbor, who would have understood, he said, when he was discovered by a National Guard flatboat. He was arrested for theft. It was an honest misunderstanding, he said, one that would be straightened out soon enough. Zaytun pondered the many puzzling aspects to Jerry's presence. First, he seemed to be the only prisoner in the complex entertained by the state of affairs, being held at Camp Greyhound. Second, why had he been put in their cage? There were 15 other cages, many of them empty. There didn't seem to be any logic to taking a man brought in for gasoline siphoning and placing him with 4 men suspected of working together on crimes varying from looting to terrorism. Jerry asked how the rest of them had come to be in Camp Greyhound. Todd told the story for the 4 of them. Jerry said something about how badly the 4 of them had gotten screwed. It was all common small talk, and Zaytun was tuning out when Jerry changed his tone and line of questioning. He began to direct his efforts toward Zaytun and Nasser. He asked questions that didn't flow from the conversational strands he had begun. He made disparaging remarks about the United States. He joked about George W. Bush, about the administration's dismal response to the disaster so far. He questioned the competence of the U.S. military, the wisdom of U.S. foreign policy around the world and in the Middle East in particular. Todd engaged with him, but Zaytun and Nasser chose to remain quiet. Zaytun was deeply suspicious, still trying to parse how this man had ended up in their cage and what his intentions might be.
Be nice to your mom!
While Jerry talked, Zaytun turned to see a prisoner a few cages away from him. He was white, in his mid-20s, thin, with long brown hair. He was sitting on the ground, his knees drawn up to his chest, and he was chanting the statement like a mantra, but loudly.
Be nice to your mom! Treat her kind!
The other 3 detainees in the young man's cage were visibly annoyed by him. He'd apparently been repeating these strange directives for some time, and Zaytun had only begun to hear them.
Don't play with matches! Fire is dangerous! He said, rocking back and forth.
The man was disabled in some way. Zaytun watched him carefully. He wasn't right in the head. He seemed to have been stunted mentally at no more than 5 or 6 years of age. He recited basic rules and warnings that a very small child might be asked to memorize in kindergarten.
Don't hurt your mom! Be nice to your mom!
He went on like this. His cage mates hushed him and even nudged him with their feet, but he took no notice. He was in something like a trance state. Because the train engine was so loud, his chanting wasn't much of a nuisance for anyone else. But his child's mind could not seem to understand where he was or why. One of the guards, sitting a few yards away from the man's cage, kept insisting that he stay in the middle of the enclosure where he could be easily seen. Any movement, left or right, was forbidden. But the man in the cage didn't understand this. He would simply get up and move over to another side. What motivated the man to decide it was time to move from here to there was unclear, but the unprovoked and unsanctioned movement enraged the guard.
"Get back there, where I can see you!"
he yelled. The man didn't know he was being addressed.
"Brush your teeth before bed," he was saying. "Wash your arms and hands. Go pee-pee now so you don't wet the bed."
The guard stood.
"Get back over there, or I'm gonna come down on you, motherfucker!"
The man remained where he was, in an unsanctioned part of the cage. There he continued to rock, squatting, focused on the space between his feet.
"I'm going to count to three," the guard yelled.
The man, in an almost deliberate provocation, reached out and touched the fence. That was it. The guard got up, and a few seconds later returned with another guard. The second guard was carrying something that looked like a fire extinguisher. They opened the cage. As they did, the man looked up, suddenly afraid. His eyes were wide with wonder and surprise as they lifted him to his feet and dragged him out of the cage. A few feet away, they dropped him on the pavement, and with the help of two more guards, they tied his hands and feet with plastic handcuffs. He didn't resist. Then they stepped away, and the first guard, the one who had warned him, aimed the hose and sprayed him head to toe with a substance Zaytoon could not immediately discern.
"Pepper spray," Todd said.
The man disappeared in the haze and screamed like a scalded child. When the smoke cleared, he was cowering in a fetal position, wailing like an animal, trying to reach his eyes with his hands.
"Get the bucket," the guard said.
Another guard came over and dumped a bucket of water on the screaming man.
They didn't say another word. They left him screaming, and soon moaning, soaked and gassed, on the pavement behind the Greyhound station. After a few minutes, they dragged him to his feet and returned him to the cage.
"You have to wash the pepper spray off," Todd explained. "Otherwise you get burned, blistered."
This night's MRE was beef stew. Zaytoon ate. The smell of pepper spray hung in the air. The previous night had been calm compared to the day, but this night brought more fury, more violence. Other prisoners had been added to the cages throughout the evening, and now there were more than 70 at Camp Greyhound. They were angry. There was less space, more agitation. There were challenges issued by the prisoners to the guards, and soon more pepper sprayings. Always the procedure was the same. A prisoner would be removed from his cage and dragged to the ground nearby, in full view of the rest of the prisoners. His hands and feet would be tied, and then, sometimes with the guard's knee on his back, he'd be sprayed directly in the face. If the prisoner protested, the knee would dig deeper into his back. The spraying would continue until his spirit was broken. Then he would be doused with the bucket and returned to his cage. Zaytun had watched elephants as a boy when a Lebanese circus passed through Jable. Their trainers used large steel hooks to pull the beasts one way or the other, to prod or punish them. The hooks looked like crowbars or ice picks, and the trainers would grab the elephants between the folds of their hide and then pull or twist. Zaytun thought of the trainers now, how these guards too had been trained to deal with a certain kind of animal. They were accustomed to hardened maximum security prisoners, and their tools were too severe to work with these men, so many of them guilty of the smallest of crimes, curfew violations, trespassing, public drunkenness. The night dragged on. There were bursts of screaming, wailing. Arguments broke out among prisoners. Guards would leap up, remove a man, put him in a new cage. But the fighting continued. The prisoners this night were wired, agitated. Zaytun and Nasser brushed whatever dust they could over their hands and arms and neck to cleanse themselves, and they prayed. The guilt Zaytun now felt was profound and growing. Kathy had been right. He shouldn't have stayed in the city, and he certainly shouldn't have stayed when she asked him, every day after the storm, to get out. "I'm so sorry, Kathy," he thought. He couldn't imagine the suffering Kathy was enduring now. She'd said every day that something bad could happen, something unexpected, and now she'd been proven right. She didn't know if he was alive or dead, and every indication would point to the latter. Anything in this prison would be tolerable if he could only call her. He didn't want to imagine what she was telling the kids, what kinds of questions they'd be asking. But why not allow the prisoners their phone call? Anyway, he approached the question, he couldn't see the logic in prohibiting calls. It was troublesome, maybe, to escort the prisoners into the station to make the calls, but wouldn't the calls end up relieving the prison of at least some of the jailed? Any municipal jail, he figured, expects many of their prisoners to leave within a day or two, through bonds or drop charges or any number of outcomes for the small-time offender. The ban on phone calls was, then, purely punitive, just as the pepper spraying of the child man had been born of a combination of opportunity, cruelty, ambivalence, and sport. There was no utility in that, just as there was no utility in barring all prisoners from contacting the outside world. "Oh, Kathy," he thought. "Kathy, I'm so sorry. Zachary, Nadima, Aisha, Safiya, I am so very sorry tonight that I was not and am not with you." By 2 or 3 in the morning, most of the prisoners were asleep, and those who remained awake with Zaytun were quiet. Again, Zaytun refused to sleep on the pavement, and caught only occasional rest by draping himself over the steel rack. He knew the conditions had begun to take a very real toll on his psyche. He'd been angry until now, but he'd been thinking clearly. Now, the connections were more tenuous. He had wild thoughts of escape. He pondered whether something very bad might happen to him here, and throughout the night he thought of the child man and heard his screams. Under any normal circumstances, he would have leapt to the defense of a man victimized as that man had been. But that he had to watch, helpless, knowing how depraved it was. This was punishment for the other prisoners, too. It diminished the humanity of them all. Thursday, September 8th. Zaytun woke to screams and curses. He had somehow managed to doze off in the early hours while draped over the steel rack. He stood and saw that down the line of cages, more prisoners were being sprayed. Now the guards were shooting the pepper spray through the fencing. They didn't bother removing the prisoners from their cages. The tactic lessened the individual dosages, but spread the gas all over the complex. After Zaytun and Nasser prayed, they and the rest of the prisoners spent the morning shielding their eyes and mouths with their shirts, coughing through the poison. The splinter in Zaytun's foot was now infected. It had darkened to a dull blue overnight, and he could no longer put any weight on it. He had seen his workers, most of whom were uninsured and afraid to register at a hospital, ignore their injuries. Broken fingers went unset. Horrible cuts went untreated and led to all manner of sickness. Zaytun had no idea what kind of object was lodged inside him, but knew he needed to take it out as soon as possible. All he needed was a moment of attention, a sterile needle, a knife even, anything to carve into the foot and remove whatever was lodged inside. The pain was intense, and Zaytun's cage mates tried to help, to come up with a solution, anything sharp to use on it. But none of them had even a set of keys. Minutes later, a man emerged from the station and came toward him. He was wearing green hospital scrubs and had a stethoscope around his neck. He was portly, with a kind face and a duck-like walk. The relief Zaytun felt in the seconds he saw him approach was beyond measure.
"Doctor!" Zaytun called.
The man didn't break stride. "I'm not a doctor," he said, and continued on. Breakfast again was MREs, an omelet filled with bacon, and again Zaytun and Nasser gave their pork to Todd and Ronnie. But there was something new to the breakfast this day, Tabasco, and Zaytun had an idea. He took the small bottle and slammed it on the cement, breaking it into shards and blades. He took the sharpest piece and cut into the swollen area of his foot, releasing far more fluid, clear, then white, then red, than he thought possible. Then he cut through to the dark object lodged inside, and after soaking his foot in blood, he pried it out. It was a metal sliver, the size of a toothpick. He wrapped his foot in all the extra paper napkins in the cage, and the relief was immediate. Throughout the day, there were more pepper sprayings, both individual treatments and more indiscriminate ones. In the late afternoon, one of the guards brought out a thick-barreled gun and shot it into one of the cages. Zaytun thought a man had been killed until he saw that the gun was shooting not bullets, but beanbags. The victim writhed on the ground, holding his stomach. From then on, the beanbag gun became a favorite weapon for submission. The guards alternated between the pepper spray and the beanbag gun, shooting the men and women in the cages. Jerry continued to engage Zaytun and Nasser in conversation. He was pointedly uninterested in Todd and Ronnie. He asked Zaytun more about his heritage, about Syria, about his career, about his visits back home. He churned through the same line of questioning with Nasser, always disguising it with good cheer and innocent curiosity. Nasser, reticent by nature, withdrew almost completely. Zaytun tried to brush off the questions, feigning exhaustion. The presence of Jerry grew more unsettling by the day. Who was he? Why, when there were almost 100 prisoners elsewhere in the complex, was he in their cage? Todd would later insist that he'd been a spy, a plant, meant to glean information from the Syrians in the cage. Of course he was undercover, Todd said. But if this were true, Zaytun thought, he was a very dedicated public servant. He ate outside in the cage, and when night fell and the air cooled, he slept as Zaytun's cage mate slept, without blankets or pillows on the filthy ground. That night, when it was his turn to lie over the guardrail in the cage, Zaytun tried to do so comfortably but couldn't. There was a new pain in his side, coming from the area of his right kidney. The pain was sharp when he tried to drape himself over the steel rail, and when he stood in place, it dulled, but remained. It was yet another thing to think about, another reason he wouldn't find rest this night.
Friday, September 9th. At midday, Zaytoun and the cage mates were told that they'd be moving out of Camp Greyhound. A series of school buses pulled into the far area of the lot. Zaytoun was removed from his cage, handcuffed, and pushed toward one of the buses. He was lined up and then handcuffed to another prisoner, a man in his 60s. It was a simple school bus, decades old. Zaytoun and his companion were told to board. They shuffled up the steps, past the armed driver and a handful of armed guards, and sat down. Todd, Nasser, and Ronnie, all paired with new men, were brought onto the bus. None of the 50 prisoners on board were told where they were going. Zaytoun looked for Jerry, but he was no longer with them. He was gone. They drove out of the city, heading north. Zaytoun and the man to whom he was handcuffed didn't talk. Few prisoners spoke. Some seemed to know where the bus was heading. Others couldn't imagine what was next. Still others seemed content that finally they were out of the bus station, that it couldn't possibly get worse. They left the city, and Zaytoun saw the first expanse of dry land he'd witnessed since the storm. It reminded him of reaching port after a long trip at sea. The temptation was to leap from the ship and dance and run on the solid and limitless earth. 40 miles on, Zaytoun saw a sign on the highway indicating that they were approaching the town of St. Gabriel. He took this as a positive sign, or a darkly comic one. In Islam, the Archangel Gabriel, the same Gabriel who in the Bible spoke to the Virgin Mary and foretold the birth of Jesus, is believed to be the messenger who revealed the Quran to the Prophet Muhammad. In the Quran, Gabriel's described as having 600 wings and is assumed to have accompanied Muhammad when he ascended to the heavens. The bus slowed at what at first looked like a country club. There was a vast green lawn enclosed by a white fence, the kind typically surrounding a horse ranch. The bus turned and passed through a gate of red brick. On the entranceway, Zaytoun saw a sign confirming where they were. The Elaine Hunt Correctional Center. It was a maximum security prison. Most of the men on the bus seemed unsurprised. The silence was absolute. They made their way down a long driveway lined with tidy trees. White birds scattered as they approached another gate, this one resembling a highway toll booth. A guard waved the bus through, and soon they arrived within the prison grounds. Hunt Correctional Center was a complex of one-story red brick buildings laid out across an immaculate green campus. Everything was arranged in orderly grids. The fences and the barbed wire atop them gleamed in the sun. The grass was bright and newly cut. Sprinklers ticked and spun in the distance. The prisoners were processed one by one at tables placed outside. Zaytoun's entrance interview was brief, and his hosts were polite. Two women asked him about his health, any medications he was using, his food restrictions. He was struck by how professional and respectful they were. It occurred to him that this level of professionalism might mean that standard procedure, a phone call for the accused, would be observed, and he'd be free within a day or two. At the very least, Kathy would know he was alive. That was all that mattered. They were brought into a changing room and told to strip naked. Zaytoun did so in the company of a dozen other men, and with such numbers he didn't fear strip searches or violence. He removed his shirt, shorts, and underwear, and they were taken away by prison workers. He and the other prisoners were given orange, short-sleeved jumpsuits. They weren't given underwear. Zaytoun stepped into the jumpsuit, zipped it up, and put his shoes back on. They were put back on a bus,
and driven through the prison complex, an array of geometrically arranged buildings with blue roofs. The bus stopped at what seemed to be the last prison block, in what was evidently the highest security section of the prison. Zaytun and the others on the bus were led into one of the long cell blocks. He was brought down a long concrete hallway and then directed into a cell. It was no more than 6 feet by 8 feet, meant for one prisoner. Nasser was inside already. The door closed. The bars were baby blue. The cell was constructed entirely from cement. The toilet was molded from cement and placed in the center of the cell. The bed, on the side of the room, was made of cement, with a rubber mattress atop it. On the back wall, there was a small window covered in thick plexiglass. A vague white square was visible, presumably the sky. Zaytun and Nasser barely spoke. There was nothing to say. They both knew their predicament had just taken a far more serious turn. The two Syrian Americans had been isolated. When they'd been caged with Todd and Ronnie, it seemed possible that the charges against them, whenever they were actually leveled, might be limited to looting. But now the two Syrians had been separated from the Americans, and there was no predicting where this would go. Zaytun remained certain that one phone call would free him. He was a successful and well-known man. His name was known all over the city of New Orleans. He only needed to reach Kathy, and she'd knock down every wall to get to him. All day Zaytun made it his business to sit by the bars, waving a napkin, pleading with the guards to grant him a call. The guards seemed to relish concocting variations of their denials. "Phone's broken," they would say. "Not today. Lines are down. Maybe tomorrow. What'll you do for me? Not my problem. You're not our prisoner." This was the first, but not the last, time Zaytun would hear this. He hadn't been processed in a traditional way and wasn't assigned to Hunt for the long term. Therefore, he was not technically a Hunt prisoner, and so wasn't bound by the institution's standard operating procedure. This was what Zaytun was told many times by the guards. "Your FEMA's problem." FEMA was footing the bill for his incarceration, they said, and that of all the other prisoners from New Orleans. The Elaine Hunt Correctional Center was renting space to warehouse these men, but otherwise made no claims to their welfare or rights. The night came, but was barely distinguishable from the day. The lights were out by 10, but the prison was full of voices. Prisoners talked, laughed, screamed. There were various unidentifiable sounds coming from all corners. Smacking, grunting. The smoke seemed to increase as the night went on. The smells were rancid. Cigarettes, marijuana, old food, sweat, decay. The pain in Zaytun's side had gotten worse. It was a throbbing ache, as if his kidney were inflamed. He never over-worried about any such problems. But what if Kathy had been right, that toxins in New Orleans had found their way into his body? Or perhaps it was the pepper spray at Greyhound. He'd surely inhaled enough of the gas to cause some internal reaction. But he dismissed the pain. He could think only of Kathy. It had now been 4 days since she'd heard from him. He couldn't imagine her suffering. Where would his mind be if she went missing for 4 days? He hoped she hadn't told the children. He hoped she hadn't told anyone. He hoped she had found comfort in God. God had a plan, he was certain. In the early hours, Zaytun weakened by lack of sleep and food, and the grim nothingness of his surroundings, recalled the passage of the Quran called Al-Taqwir, or the Darkening. "In the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate. When the sun is darkening, when the stars plunge down, when the mountains have been set in motion, when the pregnant camels have been ignored, when the savage beasts have been assembled together, when the seas have been caused to overflow, when the souls have been mated, when the buried infant girl has been asked for what impiety she was slain, when the scrolls have been unfolded, when the heaven has been stripped off, when hellfire has been caused to burn fiercely, when the garden has been brought close, every soul shall know to what it is prone. So know, I swear an oath by the stars that recede, by the ones that run, the setting stars by the night when it swarms, by the morning when it sighs. Truly, that is the saying of a generous messenger, possessed of strength, secure with the possessor of the throne, one who is obeyed and trustworthy. Your companion is not one who is possessed. Saturday, September 10th. Again, Zaytun hadn't slept. The night before, the fluorescent lights above had been turned off at 10 p.m. and had come on at 3 in the morning. In this prison, 3 o'clock was considered the beginning of the day. After he and Nasser prayed, Zaytun tried to exercise inside the cell. His foot was still raw, but he jogged in place. He did push-ups, jumping jacks. The pain in his side, though, only increased with the activity. He stopped. Breakfast was sausage, which he couldn't eat, and scrambled eggs, which were nearly inedible. He took a few bites and drank the juice provided. He and Nasser sat on the bed, side by side, barely talking. The only thing on Zaytun's mind was making a phone call. There was nothing else in the world. He heard the guard coming down the hallway, picking up the breakfast trays. As soon as the footsteps were close enough, Zaytun leapt up to the front gate. The guard jumped back a step, startled by Zaytun's sudden appearance. "Please," he said, "one phone call." The guard ignored the question and instead looked around Zaytun to Nasser, who was still sitting on the bed. The guard gave Zaytun a quizzical eye and moved on to the next cell. An hour later, Zaytun heard the guard's footsteps again, and again Zaytun rose up to meet him as he passed the gate. "Please, can I make a call?" he asked. "Just to my wife." This time the guard issued a cursory shake of the head before peering around Zaytun to see Nasser, who again was sitting on the bed. Now the look the guard gave Zaytun was suggestive, even lewd. He raised his eyebrows and nodded over to Nasser. He was implying that Zaytun and Nasser were romantically engaged, and that Zaytun, fearing detection, had leapt from the bed when he heard the guard approaching. By the time Zaytun realized what the guard was implying, it was too late to argue. The guard was gone down the hall, but this implication that Zaytun was bisexual, that he would betray his wife, so enraged him that he could barely contain himself. At midday, Zaytun was taken out of his cell. He was brought to a small office where a prison guard stood next to a digital camera. He instructed Zaytun to sit down on a plastic chair. As Zaytun waited for the next command, the photographer squinted at him and cocked his head. "You eyeballing me?" he yelled. Zaytun said nothing. "Why the fuck you eyeballing me?" the photographer yelled. He went on about how difficult he would make Zaytun stay at Hunt, that a man with an attitude like that wouldn't last long. Zaytun had no idea what he'd done to provoke the man. He was still cursing as Zaytun was led out of the room and returned to his cell. In the late afternoon, Zaytun again heard footsteps coming down the hallway. He went to the front of the cell, and there he saw the same guard. "What are you two doing in there?" the guard asked.
"What are you saying?" Zaytun hissed. He'd never been so angry.
"You can't do that kind of thing in your cell, buddy," the guard said. "I thought that was against your religion anyway." That was it for Zaytun. He let loose a barrage of expletives and threats to the guard. He didn't care what happened. The guard seemed shocked.
You really talking to me that way? You know what I can do to you?
Zaytun was finished. He went to the back of the cell and folded his arms. If he were any closer, he would be too tempted to throw himself against the bars, grabbing for any part of the guard's flesh. Sunday, September 11th. In the morning, the door was opened, and four men were added to their cell. All four were African-American, between 30 and 45. Zaytun and Nasser nodded to them in greeting, and with a quick choreography about who would sit where, the new residents found places in the tiny cell. Three men sat widthwise on the bed, and three on the floor against the wall. Cramped and soaked in sweat, they rotated every hour. Zaytun no longer harbored any expectations of being granted a phone call from any of the guards he'd seen thus far. He pinned his hopes on seeing a new guard, a new employee of the prison, some visitor. He had no idea how the prison worked, how any prison worked, but he'd seen movies where lawyers walked the cell blocks, where visitors passed through. He needed to find someone like that. Any one person from the world outside. Someone who might grant one small mercy. The men in the cell told each other how they'd ended up at Hunt. All had been picked up in New Orleans after the storm. This entire wing of the prison, they said, held Katrina prisoners. We're all FEMA, one said. Two of the men had been arrested for moving furniture in situations not unlike Zaytun's. One man said he was a sanitation worker from Houston. His company had been contracted shortly after the storm to come in and begin the cleanup. One morning, he was walking from the hotel to his truck when a National Guard truck pulled up. He was arrested on the spot, handcuffed, and brought to Camp Greyhound. It was his first time behind bars, and of all the prisoners doing Katrina time, as they termed it, he was the most perplexed by it all. He had, after all, come to New Orleans at the behest of his company. He usually picked up garbage in Houston, but after the hurricane, his supervisor said they had taken a contract in New Orleans. This prisoner, thinking it would be interesting to see what had become of the city and wanting to help in its cleanup, went willingly. He was in uniform and had identification, the keys to his truck, everything. But nothing worked. He was charged with looting and put in the cages behind the bus station. Another of the cellmates said he was a fireman in New Orleans. He stayed after the storm, just as he'd been asked to stay. He was in his yard when he was picked up by a passing Humvee. They charged him with looting, loaded him into the back, and brought him to Greyhound. Zaytun learned that most of those brought to Camp Greyhound had been arraigned in a more or less standard fashion. Most had been brought inside the bus station the morning after their arrest, and in an upstairs office, a makeshift court had been arranged. There had been a judge and at least one lawyer. The arrestees were told their charges, and most of them were offered a deal. If they didn't contest the charges, they'd be given a misdemeanor conviction and would be required to perform community service hours, starting immediately. Some of those who took the bargain, thus accepting the permanent strike on their record, were promptly brought to the police station downtown, where they began repairing and repainting the damaged offices. The stabbing pain in his side, which Zaytun had first felt at Greyhound, had now amplified tenfold. It felt like a long screw was being twisted slowly into his kidney. It was difficult to sit, to stand, to lay down. Whenever he switched positions, he'd find relief for 5 minutes before the pain returned. He wasn't one to worry about such things. He'd had so many injuries over the years and rarely sought treatment. But this felt different. He thought of infections,
the many diseases Kathy had mentioned when trying to get him to leave the city. He needed to find help. There was a nurse who came through the cell block once a day, pushing a cart full of medicine, handing pills to the prisoners. Zaytun stopped her as she wheeled by. He told her about the pain. "Do you have a prescription?" she asked. He told her no, that the pain was new. "Then you need to see the doctor," she said. He asked how he could see the doctor. She told him to fill out a form describing his pain. The doctor would look at the form and then decide if Zaytun needed attention. The nurse handed him the form and wheeled her cart down the hall. Zaytun filled out the form, and when she came back on her way out, he handed it to her. After dinner, Zaytun's cellmates shared the stories they'd heard from the other prisoners they'd encountered. The prisoners who had arrived at Hunt during the first days after the storm had lived through conditions beyond comprehension. The thousands from Orleans Parish Prison, including those who were in jail for public intoxication, shoplifting, and other misdemeanors, had been left on the city's Broad Street overpass for 3 days. They'd been on television, a sea of men in orange, sitting on a roadway filthy with feces and garbage, surrounded by guards with automatic rifles. When buses finally arrived, the prisoners were taken to Hunt. Instead of being housed inside the prison, they were brought to the football stadium on the property. There they were held for days more, outside, without any kind of shelter. Thousands of prisoners, from murderers and rapists to DUIs and petty thieves, were thrown together on the stadium grass. There were no bathrooms. The prisoners urinated and defecated wherever they could. There were no pillows, sheets, sleeping bags, or dry clothing. The men were given one thin blanket each. The area on which Hunt had been built was marshland, and the ground grew wet during the night. The men slept on the mud, with no protection against the elements, bugs, or each other. There were multiple stabbings. Men fought over blankets. Water was received through two small pipes extending from the grass. The men had to wait their turn and then drink from their hands. For sustenance, prison guards took sandwiches, fashioned them into balls, and threw them over the wall of the stadium and onto the field. Whoever caught one, ate. Whoever could defend themselves, ate. Many did not eat at all. None of the men in Zaytun's cell knew whether or not these prisoners were still on the football field, or what had become of them. Monday, September 12th. In the morning, the other four men were removed from the cell, and Zaytun and Nasser were alone again. They had nothing to do but wait for any new face, anyone who might lead to recognition from the outside world that they existed here. The boredom was profound. They'd been given no books, no paper, no radio. The two men could only stare at the gray walls, the black floor, at the baby blue bars, or at each other. But they feared talking too much. They assumed they were being monitored in some way. If a spy, Jerry, could be planted with them in an outdoor cage, it would be unsurprising if their conversations were being monitored here, in a maximum security prison. Zaytun sat against the bed and closed his eyes. He wanted only to pass these days. He recounted their arrest and the hours and days before it, countless times, trying to figure out what had brought such attention to them. Was it simply that four men were occupying one house? Such a thing, after a hurricane, when most of the city had been evacuated, was worthy of investigation, he conceded. But there had been no investigation. There had been no questions, no evidence seized, no charges leveled. Kathy often worried about the National Guard and other soldiers returning to the United States after time in Iraq and Afghanistan.
She warned him about passing groups of soldiers in airports, about walking near National Guard offices. They're trained to kill people like you, she would say to Zaytun, only half-joking. She hadn't wanted their family to become collateral damage in a war that had no discernible fronts, no real shape, and no rules. Almost 20 years earlier, he'd been working on a tanker called the Andromeda. They'd just brought Kuwaiti oil to Japan and were returning to Kuwait for more. This was 1987, and Iran and Iraq were in the midst of their long and crippling war. Most of their own refineries had been destroyed during the fighting, so both nations had come to rely on imported oil, and routinely tried to blockade or damage any ships bringing oil to their enemy via the Strait of Hormuz. Zaytun and his shipmates knew that entering the Gulf of Oman, en route to the Persian Gulf, meant risking the wrath of Iraqi or Iranian submarines and warships. The seamen were paid extra for the risk. Zaytun's bunk was over the fuel tanks, and he was asleep one early morning when he was jolted by an explosion below. He didn't know if it was one of the tanks, or if the ship had struck something. He quickly realized that if the tank had exploded, he'd be dead, so they must have hit something, or if something hit them. He was rushing to the bridge to find out when another explosion shook the ship. They'd been struck twice by Iranian torpedoes. Together they'd created a hole big enough to drive a small motorboat through. But it was clear the Iranians didn't mean to sink the tanker. If they'd wanted to, that would have been quite easy. They wanted only to send a warning, and to cripple the ship. They managed to make it to Adan, and there they spent a month repairing the hull. While waiting to ship out again, Zaytun decided that perhaps his father Mahmoud had been right. It was time to settle somewhere, time to build a family, to remain safe and constant on land. A few months later, he got off the Andromeda in Houston and began searching for Kathy. Tuesday, September 13th. Zaytun and Nasser didn't discuss the possibility that they wouldn't be released from this prison for many months or even years. But they were both thinking it, that no one knew where they were, which afforded the authorities, whoever it was who wanted them kept here, complete and unchecked power to keep them detained and hidden indefinitely. Zaytun could think of no indication so far that any measure could be taken to advance his case. He hadn't been allowed to make a phone call, and there was no hint that he would ever be allowed to do so. He'd had no contact with anyone from outside. There was the nurse, but she was a full-time employee of the prison. Professing his innocence to her was futile, as professions of innocence were likely all she heard all day. In fact, he knew that his very presence in a maximum security prison likely proved his guilt in the minds of all who worked at the facility. The guards were used to overseeing men who'd been convicted at trial. Further, the prison was so isolated that there was no oversight whatsoever, no civilians who came to check on conditions. He hadn't been let out of the cell block once, and had been let out of the cell only to shower. The shower itself had bars. If they'd refused him a phone call for 7 days now, why would they change their policy in the future? He had one hope, which was to impart his name and innocence to every prisoner he might meet, so that in the event that one of them was someday released, they might not only remember his name, but also bother to call Kathy or tell someone where he was. But again, who among them would believe he was one of the true innocents in the prison? How many other names and promises had they known and made? When he was originally arrested, Zaytun hadn't been sure his country of origin had anything to do with his capture. After all, two of the four men in their group were white Americans, born in New Orleans. But the arrest had taken on an entirely different cast by the time they were brought to Camp Greyhound. And though he was loath to make this leap, Was it so improbable that he, like so many others, might be taken to an undisclosed location, to one of the secret prisons abroad, to Guantanamo Bay? He wasn't the sort to fear such things. He wasn't given to conspiracy theories or believing that the U.S. government willfully committed human rights violations. But it seemed every month another story appeared about a native of Iran, Saudi Arabia, Libya, Syria, or any one of a number of other Muslim countries who was being released after months or years from one of these detention centers. Usually the story was similar. A Muslim man came to be suspected by the U.S. government, and, under the president's current powers, U.S. agents were allowed to seize the man from anywhere in the world and bring him anywhere in the world, without ever having to charge him with a crime. How different was Zaytun's current situation? He was being held without contact, charges, bail, or trial. Would it not behoove the Department of Homeland Security to add a name to their roster of dangerous individuals? In the minds of some Americans, the very thought of two Syrians paddling through New Orleans together after a hurricane would seem suspicious enough. Even the most amateur propagandist could conjure sinister implications. Zaytun didn't entertain such thoughts lightly. They went against everything he knew and believed about his adopted country. But then again, he knew the stories. Professors, doctors, and engineers had all been seized and disappeared for months and years in the interest of national security. Why not a house painter? Wednesday, September 14th. The pain in Zaytun's side was overtaking him. While standing or sitting in certain positions, he could barely breathe. He had to get help. When he heard the nurse's cart making its way down the cell block, he jumped up to meet her at the bars. "Did you give the doctor my form?" he asked her. She said she did, and that she would hear back soon. "You look sick," Nasser said. "I know," Zaytun said. "You've lost too much weight." "The pain. It's so bad now." Zaytun had a sudden and strange thought that the pain in his side could be caused not by infection or injury, but by sorrow. Maybe there wasn't a medical reason for it. Maybe it was just the manifestation of his anger and sadness and helplessness. He didn't want any of this to be true. He didn't want it to be true that his home and his city were underwater. He didn't want it to be true that his wife and children were 1,500 miles away and might by now presume him to be dead. He didn't want it to be true that he was now and might always be a man in a cage, hidden away, no longer part of the world. Thursday, September 15th. Now Zaytun knew the rhythmic ticking of the nurse's cart like his own heartbeat. He leapt to the bars again to meet her.
"What did the doctor say?" he asked.
"About what?" she said.
"About my condition," he said.
"You gave him the form."
"Oh, you know, I don't think he got it. You better fill it out again," she said, and handed him another form.
He didn't see her again that day or the next. Zaytun began to feel faint when he rose to his feet. He wasn't eating enough. It seemed that every meal had pork at its center, and even when he could eat what was offered, he was often too agitated or despondent to do so. After lunch, three guards arrived. The gate to the cell opened, and they entered. Zaytun was handcuffed, and his legs were shackled,